is in the ground plane, and the radiator itself is a, what's the word for it now? It is a spirally wound thing. Therefore, as you change the length of that radiator, the impedance is going to be changing in a more complicated way. But by way of top hat capacitors, by way of a top hat capacitor, by way of a shunt inductor or shunt capacitor at the bottom or series, you can, if you're smart enough, you're willing to spend the time, you can make your ham stick a perfect impedance match on whatever frequency you want to. The complication now is that you're using not a simple wire antenna, because I think the ham stick is really a spiral wound thing, and I'm not sure what the ground plane is like. And if the ground plane radials big enough a number, if the ground plane, once again, that's 60 over 9 at my QTH on input. If the ground plane radials are not, if they're not big enough, then you are launching some signal onto the outside of the coax cable, and the length of the feed line is another one of the variables involved. So that article, once you find it, will give you an awful lot of the answers you're asking for. By the way, 60 over 9 at my QTH. The Nevis antenna is one where you're trying to aim the signal nearly straight up to hit the ionosphere because you want to talk to somebody at a short range. And believe it or not, nobody does it, but you could, in theory, take a nice long Yagi antenna on each one of those bands and aim it up in the air. Nobody does it that way. The real directivity, since your ham stick is really squirting signal all over the place, and you'd like to favor the signal that's going straight up, the biggest variable you've got that can do that is by adjusting the altitude of the antenna above the ground. By adjusting that altitude, because in the real world, you've got a real antenna above ground, you have a mirror image of an antenna below ground. At 40 meters, that earth in your backyard looks like dirt to your eye, to an RF signal, that dirt in your backyard is really a kind of a mirror, as I see it, Tim. And as such, you've got a real antenna above ground, you've got a mirror image antenna below ground, and for the horizontal polarization component, those mirror image and real antennas are out of phase with each other. And so as you adjust the altitude of the signal above ground, you're really adjusting for the elevation angle of where the major signal goes. So your quickest way to get Nevis function is to adjust for altitude. It's like having a phased array of these things, if you know what I mean, where you can now, with 20 feet above the ground, you've really got 40 feet of separation between the two elements of the phased array, and that gives you a lot of directivity capability to aim that signal straight up for the Nevis operation. Maybe this is some of the information you're looking for, Tim. N2, Romeo, Delta, Bravo, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yes, I'm actually using the hamstick antennas in pairs. I have them rigged in a dipole configuration. It's not a vertical antenna with ground plane radials. It's actually two hamstick antennas mounted as a horizontal dipole.
Yes, but there's a catch. DO9 at my QTH, how are you feeding them? If you're just bringing the coax cable, shield, and center conductor to your two hamsticks back to back, you're launching an awful lot of signal into the transmission line outer conductor in that process. So what kind of a balancing device you use at the junction is going to be very important to controlling the pattern. Yes, you can get away with making the shield go to one hamstick and the center conductor go to the other hamstick. It'll work. But you will be launching half of your signal onto the outside of your feed line, and your feed line will be another radiation pattern that's going to make life a little bit more difficult. And the length of that feed line, its number of wavelengths as you sweep in frequency. The length of that feed line is another one of the big variables that as you change the frequency or the length of the line, is going to be changing the VISWA in very complicated manners. So tell me that, Tim. What was the nature of the balun you used to feed your two hamsticks? N2RDB, K2RIW, and TechNet.
When I started off, I was just feeding it straight. with the coax. I had intended on taking the coax and putting about five or six turns of it into a loop, just holding them together with tie wraps. Now, of course, I could, if necessary, I could put some other kind of a balancing device in there. Wouldn't be hard to do. I might even have a one-to-one balun around the shack someplace I could use.
The one-to-one balun is a good way. The five or six turns of coax is unique. Excellent. Don't sell that short. Excellent technique, the five or six turns. So, it's a poor man's balun, but it works like... You don't necessarily have a formal balun. That five or six turns will do it. So as you read that article and as you do these experiments, I know that you can make this... Once again, 60 over 9 at my QTH. I know you can make those hams a perfect impedance match, Tim. As you spend the time doing that, it's eventually going to work like a charm. Please come back and let us know how that experiment works. Back to you for a final, Tim. N2RDB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, thank you very much, Dick. You've given me some insight. I will certainly go and read that article. Basically, what we're trying to do is to just come up with some viable options for NVIS antennas for our Aries group here in Nassau County. Now, I'm trying the bit with the ham sticks, and Mike WY2U came up with a design for a wire antenna for 80 and 40 meters that we're eventually going to build a prototype and test it out. And there's a couple of other people who somebody went out and got a buddy pole, and you know, somebody else has something that they kind of made themselves that they mount up on painter's poles. So we'll definitely get back to you with the results. Thank you very much, Dick. I do appreciate the insight. This is November 2, Romeo Delta Bravo, back to net.
Hey, Tim, you guys have got it made. If you're working with Mike Cosma, WY2U, one of the shining lights of guys who really know how to build ham radio HF antennas, it's just a matter of time. A matter of time before you guys have got it made. So how often does Mike Cosmo work with the operation that you're doing there, Tim? Go ahead.
I see Mike on a regular basis, and he got involved in our Aries group because he wants to teach, and I told him we could certainly accommodate him on that, and we're glad to have his expertise with us. And he has helped us out with one other antenna project, a dual-band VHF-UHF roll-up J-pole made out of 450-ohm ladder line. And he came in a couple of months ago, and he gave us a lesson on basically on SWR and power meters, and basically touched on some interesting things about that. And also, I belong to the Nassau Amateur Radio Club, where he designed a slot key dual band VHF UHF. This antenna was made of copper foil and PVC piping. So that as a field antenna to the Nassau Amateur Radio Club. And it was sometime after that he started helping us out in our Aries group.
Well done, Tim. You got it made. So please come back and let us know how that project went.
It certainly will. Thanks again for your time, Dick. N2RDB.
Okay, I think we've gone down the list. And John, why don't you give us one of your... by the way, each time I'm hearing that disruptive signal, it's 60 dB over S9 at the input at... As I said, 60 over 79 and MyQTH. John, let's have the first Mel's Corner question. KC2, WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
Good evening, Dick, everyone on the net. Yes. Basically, three questions about the same thing in 1 week. So we're going to get rid of three of these guys with one response from you. Now, this concerns basically a 2-meter antenna, and it's all about radios. They'd like to know, is longer better? Are more radios better? Are double-stacked radios better? These are coming from different people, but they're basically the same question. And should the radials be tuned in elevation to get the perfect match? So they have a lot of questions about radials, and it's all for a vertical, and it's all for 2 meters. So maybe you could touch on that and give them a little reason why these radials are done that way. They also said they see some slanted at 45, some go out at right angles, so I think they need a good description of what's going on there. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Yeah, what radials are really doing and how you make them work the best is a bit misunderstood by a good percentage of the ham radio population. And let me walk into radials from the back door, so to speak. Let's find out where they really came from. The most basic kind of an antenna is a dipole. In the case of a dipole, the right-hand side gets positive voltage, and the left-hand side gets negative voltage on the first half cycle of the RF energy you put into the dipole. And as long as you're using the right kind of a balancing device or a very tiny transmitter in your tuna fish can that sits in the center, that works like a charm. While that antenna is operating in completely free space, that full half-wave dipole, you could put a sheet of metal down the middle of the dipole at right angles to the wire. Put a sheet of metal there, because there is a positive field on the right-hand side and a left-hand field on the left-hand side, and essentially 0 volts in the center where the sheet of metal is. The sheet of metal makes no change in the impedance or the pattern of the dipole. Putting that infinite sheet of metal in the middle of the dipole does nothing. Your eye sees a whole lot of hardware there, and the RF energy says nothing happened. Once you've got that sheet of metal there, a great big sheet of metal, you can decide, gee, I'm going to feed the right-hand side of the dipole with reference to the sheet of metal, and I'll throw away the left-hand side of the dipole. As long as you've got an infinite sheet of metal, that works like a charm. And yes, you go from 70 ohms to 35 ohms because you're only feeding half the dipole with reference to the sheet of metal, but it'll give you a beautiful pattern, beautiful visuar, except for that 2-to-1 change. Now, let's get to the real world. In the real world, we don't want to fill up the backyard with one great big sheet of copper that goes out to infinity. We want to do something a hell of a lot smaller than that. And so, by putting some number of radials that act like a near short circuit at the feed point, that means that each one of the radials is a quarter wavelength long, because a quarter wavelength of wire where there's an open circuit at the far end gives you what looks like a short circuit at the near end. So a quarter wave electronically resonant wire, each one of them, gives you a pretty good ground plane if you had 3, 4, or 5 of them, but there's a catch. And that is, the catch is that even though the ground plane radials do their job, give you a beautiful short circuit at the feed point, almost acting like the sheet of metal, it really is a skeleton sheet of metal. You locate that above ground, there is a little bit of the RF energy going down in between the ground plane radials and hitting the earth. The earth at these frequencies is a kind of distributed dummy load. It's a distributed resistive material. So any of the RF energy that sneaks in between the radials and hits the earth is being converted into heat. Let me drop. That RF energy is hitting the earth, being absorbed by the earth, being converted into heat, and warming up the worms in the wintertime. They like it. But it's wasting some of your RF energy, and it's very difficult to quantify how much of the RF energy is going into the dirt. You could, under some circumstances, with a small number of radials and the thing mounted real close to the ground, you could have, I'm not sure the exact number, but maybe 30 or 40% of your RF energy is going into the dirt and not being radiated to earth and into sky. But even though the standing wave ratio of a well-adjusted antenna will look like beautiful match, you'll think that you're radiating all that energy. Well, it's all going down the feed line, and not much of it's reflecting back to the transmitter, But still, where is it going? Is it really going into space or some of it going into dirt? As such, as you put down more and more radials, the ability of the RF energy to sneak in between the radials and touch the Earth becomes less and less. You put down 32 or 64 radials, and now it is a skeleton circuit where the slots in between the radials are sort of waveguide beyond cutoff, and the RF doesn't go there and doesn't hit the Earth. In the case of a VHF antenna, where the whole antenna and the radials are mounted, let me pick a number, 50 feet in the air, a whole lot of wavelength in the air, even though you've got three simple little stubby radials slanted down at a 45-degree angle, and three of them every 120 degrees around the circumference of that monopole antenna, your station master-like antenna, even though only three of them is there, and the RF energy is going down in between those radials. Because those radials are, let me pick a number, four wavelengths above the ground, the RF energy that goes in between the radials doesn't get a chance to touch the ground. And so, even though the same amount of RF is going between the radials, in that case, does not give you loss. Ain't that crazy? So therefore, the radios that you're building, you'd like them to be a lot of them. You'd like the whole antenna to be mounted above Earth in order not to be getting RF loss into the dirt. Once you see what's really going on here, you'll realize that, yeah, you can spend all of the effort of insisting that the antenna be right flat on the ground, which is not the right place. Altitude helps. And you could make sure the dirt disappears by putting down 64 radials if you really want to get 98% efficiency. There's a hell of a lot easier way of doing it. As long as the tree is tall enough or the tower is tall enough, there's nothing stopping you from hanging a pure, pure vertically polarized half-wave dipole. And you have the choice of either feeding it at the bottom on the outer edge or feeding in the center. Once you feed a real vertical dipole, the other half of the dipole is taking the place of the ground plane radials. One simple radial, in that case, one radiator, acts like 64 individual radiators. You'll get the same performance of 64 radiators by making it a half-wave, pure vertical dipole, an unpopular antenna because people don't understand it. And top of that, the whole antenna, the phase center of the antenna is higher above the ground, going to give you a lower angle of radiation. It's going to clear the trees and the buildings and whatever a hell of a lot better. So if you have the resources and you're willing to not put down 32 radials, but you're just willing to hang the thing a little bit taller, put up a tower, you choose the right tree or whatever, a half-wave dipole is going to give you a lot more performance than you would get with
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
A simple half-wave dipole is going to give you a hell of a lot more performance than you would get out of a ground-mounted, ground-plane quarter-wave antenna with 64 radials, and very few of us are willing to do that. Now, what you've heard is a whole lot of opinions. You express those opinions on the 20-meter band on a Saturday afternoon, and there's going to be a whole lot of people that disagree with you. But you start asking those people, how many of you guys have really built a pure half-wave, vertically polarized dipole? I'll be amazed if it's one guy per thousand who has actually done it. But when you find the guy who has done it, boy, he's got a brand new religion. He's going to say, the performance I get out of the thing is out of sight. How can such a simple antenna be so potent? You finally find the guy who's done it, and you're going to find out, wow, does that thing work? Why hasn't somebody told me about that sooner? That's my particular story about radials. There's a lot more to the story, but I think you got the beginning of it, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick, I know that in their paragraphs here, they're asking a question without realizing it. And that question is, they think it might be better, but from what you're saying, it'd be a waste of time, to put a solid conical shape below as a counterpoise. But from what you're saying, that's unnecessary. Is that correct?
N2NNU.
Boy, is that unnecessary. Yeah, you could make a double conical antenna. You could make a disc cone antenna on HF if you wanted to. Very complicated structure, if you know what I mean. You could do that. But once you realize what the counterpoise is doing, let me give you one other understanding of why you build the ground plane radios, the counterpoise. in order to pump current into your radiating section of a quarter wave antenna, you have to stand somewhere to push the energy into it. In other words, assume now I've got Arnold Schwarzenegger floating in the cargo hold of the space shuttle in free space. He's in weightlessness of space. He's a 200-pound man, and in his hand is a 200-pound barbell. He pushes the 200-pound barbell 1 meter per second to the north. By action-reaction, his body will move 1 meter per second to the south. Equal in action, equal and opposite reaction. Newton's third law. That's what happens with mechanical pushing. In the case of electronic pushing, your feed line is trying to pump current into the radiator. On the first half cycle, you're trying to put positive polarity. You're pumping positive current into the radiator, but you have to be taking negative current out of something. That's the ground plane radial. That's the ground plane radial system. You've got to stand somewhere to do the pushing, if you know what I mean. It's got to come from somewhere. In the case of a full halfway dipole, the current you're pushing into the positive side is coming from the left-hand side. It's a thoroughly balanced system. On the second... On the second half cycle, you do the exact opposite. So what the ground plane radial system is doing is giving you a place to stand when you do the push. As long as you're willing to build a full half-wave dipole, you've got it. The full half-wave dipole, the other half, is acting like an infinite sheet of metal or a perfect cone of radials where every one of them is properly tuned. You can do it by building that other circuit, but it takes a hell of a lot of circuit to do it. Now, I think Alex has got some opinion on this, because I bet you he's built a whole lot of ground plane antennas. N2NNU, K2RIW. Go right ahead, Alex.
Yes, Dick. No, I'm not very fond of ground planes, thinking that half of my energy is wasted in the radials. But I thought perhaps it's worth to mention that the feeding point of any vertical depends on the angle of the radials to the vertical. So if you have radiators at about 120 degrees in respect to the radiator, then you have about 50 ohm impedance there, and you do not need any matching system. So what I'm trying to say here is that the feeding point of a vertical antenna depends on the angle of the radials to the radiator. Back to you.
I agree with you, Alex. As you set those ground plane radials at a particular angle, and there's the right number of them, and they have the right kind of tuning, you can force the antenna, the radiator, which wants to be a 35-ohm antenna, you can force it to be 50 ohms of resistance. However, in the case of HF, to make that cone of radials, the right number of them at the right angles, at the right altitude above the ground, to make that a 50-ohm antenna, in my opinion, is one way to go, but it's a difficult way to go. Whatever I use for my counterpoise, no matter how I match the antenna, if I adjust the radiating system to be the right length, the resistive component will be 50 ohms if that's what I want. Or if I've got 35-ohm cable, I can make it 35 ohms. Or if I've got 200-ohm twin lead, I can make it 200 ohms. By adjusting the length of the radiator by way of those Brown and Woodward curves that I told you about earlier, you can make the resistive component anything you want, from 1 ohm to 1,000 ohms inclusive. Once you have chosen the length that gives you the resistive component you're happy with, in general, there will always be some inductance or capacitance left over. You put one simple shunt or series reactor in series or in parallel with the antenna, and the reactive component disappears. So if you're willing to use one simple inductor or capacitor on the antenna for the particular antenna you've got, you can force it to be 50 ohms. You don't have to do all of that elaborate mechanical thing of setting up a whole lot of ground plane radials at 120-degree slant down angle, if you know what I mean. That's an opinion. Not everybody's going to agree with me on that one. I would much rather do it electronically than mechanically once you see the principle of operation. The real principle of operation here is that those ground plane radials are simply the counterpoise. It's the thing you stand on to do the pushing. And if you make that thing... And if you make that thing you stand on to do the pushing a resonating structure like the other half of a dipole, because you're making a full half-wave vertically polarized dipole. And life is a hell of a lot simpler, and the performance is a hell of a lot higher. You get a lot more bang for the dollar, if you know what I mean. You've got more altitude, you've got more efficiency, you're further away from the Earth, you're not lighting up the Earth, you don't need a zillion ground plane radials. The only disadvantage is now you need a taller structure to mount this full half-wave vertical dipole. But there's even ways of getting around that. Once you've decided to make a full half-wave vertical dipole, I can mechanically shrink it down by zigzagging it, loading coils, top hat capacitors. There's all kinds of ways I can squeeze it into a smaller package so that my particular tree that's not tall enough will do the job. That's an easier approach. I would rather use the electronic approach than the mechanical approach. I'd rather work smarter than harder. But that's in one man's opinion. And I haven't built that many, but the few guys who have. And by the way, once again, the way you feed a dipole, if you do decide to make it a pure vertical half-wave dipole, the first thing you're going to think about is, gee, to put the feed line in the middle of that and bring the feed line off at a right angle, mechanically that's very difficult. It is, but there's a simple solution. Let me drop. It is the fear of bringing off that dipole feed line in the center for the vertically polarized dipole at right angles. The fear of bringing that dipole off to one side is what stops an awful lot of people from doing that. If you're smart enough, there is nothing magic about the way you feed a dipole. The dipole really is a flywheel that you're putting energy into it, and the energy is going to bounce back and forth 20 times before it becomes radiated in space. That's why you resonate it, to make sure that all of those bounces stay in step with each other. But once you realize it is a resonating structure, and as long as you're smart enough to use the right kind of a balance, you don't have to feed it in the center. Nothing magic about that. It's just a classic way of doing it. You can feed it 10% off-center, 50% off-center, or you can feed it at the outer edge, and it'll work like a charm. And if it's a pure vertical dipole and you feed it at the bottom, it looks like a cardioid, it looks like a ground plane antenna, except that it's a half-wave long resonator, radiator. And when you feed it at the bottom, the only disadvantage is now you're feeding a 1,500-ohm impedance instead of a 50-ohm impedance with a simple step-up transformer, which could be one simple LC network, or a real tapped coil, your choice. Feeding a 1,500-ohm at the outer edge from the bottom is very simple. You can get 100% efficiency feeding a dipole anywhere from center to outer edge if you're smart enough. And I think these guys that write emails to you are smart enough, in my opinion, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW of the TechNet.
KW.
You want to pick that up, Dick?
Yeah, somebody with a very low voice who said something KW. Want to run that by again? Give me your call letters and name, sir.
Yeah, hi. I hear a loud hum. I don't know if it's coming over the air or not. This is Alan, November 2, Kilo Whiskey, with a comment.
Okay, Alan, there is a little bit of hum on your signal, but you sound pretty good. November 2, Kilo Whiskey. Go right ahead with your comment. And I know it's a radical-sounding idea that you can feed a dipole way off to one side if you're smart enough. Over to you, Alan.
Okay, well, I'm a great fan of the vertical dipole and vertical polarization in general, because I believe that takeoff angle is at least as important as azimuth. And nobody would call Europe with their beam pointed at South America, but they don't seem to get it that, you know, the antenna height matters. Where in the world you're going to get it? But that's not what I wanted to comment on. What I wanted to comment on is what you got to watch out for with that vertical dipole is the end of any dipole is the high voltage point. And if you've got a vertical dipole, the end of it, if it's accessible to people at ground level, it's at a very high voltage point. There's a hazard there. I won't mention any names, but we used to tease a fellow. We used to nickname him Moses because he had one end of his inverted L going past the bush in front of his house. 3 o'clock in the morning, his neighbor rang his bell and said, "You know your bush is on fire."
Al, you brought up a good point. Without a doubt, there is high voltage at the end of a half-wave dipole. And if you're running 100 watts to 1,000 watts into that dipole, that voltage is a pretty fierce voltage. We're talking about a few thousand volts. As far as arcing over to the tree or to the telephone pole or to the bush at the bottom, you've got to take some care to make sure you've got a couple of feet, at least a foot of spacing between the dipole, its insulator, and the rest of the hardware around that it could possibly arc over to. You've got to do some extra care. And at the top of the dipole, if it's near a tree, you make sure you clear the branches away from the top area because it could possibly arc over to it. And is that a fire hazard? If it was a real dry tree on a hot summer day and it has rained for a whole long time, could you catch the tree on fire? Yes, that is a possibility. So, fire hazard because of arcing, you've got it correctly. When it comes to human beings being near it, it's not as much of a hazard as you would think. Yes, if it arced over to a human being, the human being would sense the heat, and he would back away from it immediately. The next thing a person would say is, because the voltage is so high, you're going to electrocute the human being. Not necessarily true. At RF frequencies, because of the skin effect, that RF energy doesn't penetrate very far below the skin. So the skin will experience some heat. You're not going to create the... unless the guy has got a defibrillator that you've interfered with, you're not going to create an electrocution hazard per se. Now, Alex, of course, will tell us that there is a radio frequency biohazard. If a person was standing near the base of the antenna, a foot away from it, while you're running down key down power, and he stands there for 6 minutes, without a doubt, he's pushing his luck. There's the possibility he could develop eye damage from that because of the thermal effects. So, yes, you've got a good point, and you've got to be extra careful with the vertical half-wave dipole. Make sure that the things near the tips of the dipole...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Assume that in the worst case, the dipole could arc over to something a foot away. Make sure that a foot away, there is enough insulator length and enough airspace so that it doesn't arc over to it. And other than that, I think it's going to work like a charm. In the case of the QRP type of power that K2YEW always ran, Mel. He had a simple green piece of insulated wire running up the evergreen tree in the front of his house with a very simple insulator at the top. He fed it at the bottom, and he never ran into any arcing problems, and it worked like a charm for him. That was Mel, K2KEY. Boy, how quick I forget. The poor guy has not been gone that long. K2KEY. I'm confusing him with another guy who used to run another TechNet on Long Island. Anyhow, because of the low power he ran, he never ran into an arcing problem. But he's not a kilowatt type person. Okay, so this is far from all the information about ground plane radials, about vertical dipoles, about various ways of feeding them. There's a lot more to the story. But at least I hope this is going to help some, John. To be KC2WGB, K2LIW.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. No, I think that's going to give them a good leg up on understanding radio and what they're trying to do. Let me let it drop, and I'm going to describe something that was constructed and his questions. Let me let it drop. Okay. I have Sid here that has constructed a 2-meter Yagi setup. There's two Yagis, identical Yagis. They're set approximately a half a wavelength over each other, directly in line. However, the one on top is on a motorized track with a stepper motor, and he can move that antenna from perfect alignment in the front, along the boom lane, all the way back to the end of the other antenna on this track that he's built. It's quite an arrangement. What he's experimenting with is using it to cancel out signals. And when he has it pointed at a station, a distant station, and he brings the upper antenna toward the rear, where he's going to get a 180-degree phase shift, he does not notice a drastic reduction. Maybe you can tell him what's going on there.
Very interesting arrangement, John. If you've seen a photograph of this, first of all, roughly how many elements is there to each one of those Yagis, John? Go ahead.
It looks like 11 elements from what I can see.
Wow. There's a biggie. An 11-element Yagi on 2 meters, I'm guessing is in the vicinity, roughly 15 feet of boom? What would you think, John?
N2, N, N, you?
Dick, I would believe, yeah, it's got to be more than 10 feet. It looks big.
Yeah, Alex, recognize. We'll get back to you in a minute, Alex. The 15 feet of boom on 2 meters with 11 elements probably has an effective capture area in the vicinity of 12-foot diameter circle. If your eyes operated at 2 meters and you look down the throat of one of those Yagis, it is sucking up RF energy from space with the right polarization and the right angle of arrival from roughly a 10 or 12-foot diameter of space. That is the effective capture area of one single Yagi with a 15-foot long boom and 11 elements. Therefore, the correct stacking distance for those two antennas is around 10 or 12 feet. Let's call it 10 feet. 10 feet is the right stacking distance. He's got them a half wavelength apart, which is around 36 inches. So he's got them 3 feet apart instead of 10 or 12 feet apart. Therefore, the two Yagis are heavily coupled to each other. And they're not acting as independent items. They've got an extremely strong coupling coefficient. By the way, moving one Yagi versus the other is really doing a kind of vertically tuned phased array. You could have two Yagis, one 10 or 12 feet above the other, and you electronically switch the signals to them like as if you were using a trombone. Let me drop. If I was using a trombone so that I could delay the signal going to the upper Yagi versus the lower Yagi, and because a phased array always fires in the direction of the delay, as I expand the trombone and put a longer feed length of line to the upper antenna, which means the upper antenna gets the signal later, that will take the vertical beamwidth out of that antenna and steer it at a higher elevation. You would be electronically steering the beam when you electronically change the phase of the signal going to the two driven elements. By mechanically moving the antenna, you're doing something very similar, and by moving one antenna forward and aft compared to the other, by moving the upper antenna aft, you're again steering the beam vertically if and only if the antennas are acting as two independent items. And by the way, when you steer that beam in elevation by a number of degrees that's greater than the vertical beam width of one single Yagi. Let me drop and explain that one. Every phased array has what's called the element pattern and the array pattern. The individual elements have a certain pattern in horizontal and vertical beam width. Depending on what phase angle you feed the individual elements, that gives you an array pattern as if each one of the elements was an isotropic radiator, even though they're not. The final pattern of the phased array is the product of the element pattern and the array pattern. Let me give you an example. If, for instance, my individual Yagis had, I'm going to pick a number out of the air, let's assume that they had a 30-degree beamwidth, and they're in that ballpark, plus or minus 15 degrees in elevation, plus or minus 15 degrees in azimuth. So the individual Yagis, the element pattern, the element of the phased array, has got a 15-degree pattern to it. And now if I electronically use my trombone to delay the signal going to the upper Yagi compared to the lower Yagi, and I delay it by an amount that shifts the elevation beam by 15 degrees, that's the 3 dB down point of the element pattern, I will get a beam that is now steered up in elevation at 15 degrees, but because the element patterns are 3 dB down there, the pattern will fall off 3 dB in gain when I do that. So he's got a double error going here, a triple error. Number one, they're so darn close, they're so coupled, they're not independent items. Number two, he's trying to form a complete null by moving the elevation pattern by a number of degrees so that the null on the horizon toward the signal he wants to disappear is going to be a deep null. With that cross-coupling, he's not getting it. He's also getting ground reflection. My guess is the signal went up and down a little bit, but once you understand the physics of what's going on with this particular phased array, he's got the beginning of a very good idea, but he's got to make some improvements in the way he's deployed it. He needs a greater spacing between the antennas is the beginning of the process. He has
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
He has to also agree that he's going to be getting ground reflections. He's going to be getting reflections off of other things in the environment. So by steering the beam only in elevation, and that's what his sliding arrangement is doing, it is only moving the elevation of the array. If the spacing was great enough that he really could steer the array in elevation, would he get a really deep notch on the horizon when the antenna is aimed in that direction is an interesting question. But and is that the way to null that signal? Well, you're now going to null all signals on the horizon that come from that particular azimuth, and signals from other azimuths will not be nulled as much, but that's a tough way to go to eliminate a bad signal. To eliminate a bad signal is half the problem, but you want to simultaneously peak on the good signal. And right now, that method of electronically phasing is moving the main lobe beam up in the air, and as long as he's talking to an aircraft that's 15 degrees above the horizon, that's a good way to go. But most of the ham radio signals he listens to do not come from that elevation. So he maybe is not doing what he thinks he's doing, as I see it, John. KC2 WGB, K2LIW, McNair.
Okay, Dick, and I understand his dilemma here, because to have a separation of 10 or 12 feet, now to make that transition with that antenna to move along the same axis as the boom below it, is going to be quite difficult. What I would suggest, but he can't do that either, was to have one move forward and one move in reverse, so we didn't have to have such a long translation rate. He definitely has a problem here. But I know what he's trying to do. When he gets a signal, he wants to make sure he's right on it. So when he backs off that antenna and reduces the signal, he can hone in a little better. He's using all stepper motors, so he has very good control. But I think he has to work on this a little more. I may contact him, and I hope he's listening so he understands the dilemma, because it's very important for him to accomplish that. Mechanically, that's going to be an effort.
Yeah, under ordinary circumstances, if you create a null in an antenna pattern, and then you switch the antenna mechanically in azimuth and elevation, that null is usually very sharp, and yes, you know that you peaked on the signal. But this is now an elevation null, not an azimuth null, and after he gets the null, he's going to be sweeping the antenna in azimuth. If he used a very elaborate computer modeling program, and if he plugged in all the parameters of what he's doing, and if he saw the pattern in three-dimensional space, he would discover that the pattern he's generating has a number of pancake-like vertical lobes that are narrow in elevation but broad in azimuth, and they're going to have a funny kind of a curve in azimuth at the same time. So even though he can steer a null on the signal, once he carries this out correctly, it's going to be an elevation null, but he is not now mechanically sweeping the antenna in elevation. He's sweeping it in azimuth, and in azimuth, the null is not sharp. It's only sharp in elevation. So it's not going to quite do what he wants. He's an enthusiastic guy, and he's got some nice mechanical structure. But in the big picture, if I was weighing the pros and cons of electronically steering by using a trombone-like device or some other kind of phase shifter, switching in lengths of cable and electronically steering the beam to the upper Yagi versus the lower, to electronically steer the beam is going to be a hell of a lot easier than mechanical. To take 15-foot-long booms and move them on a track assembly is a very tough way to go to do the same thing. Believe it or not, whether you delay the signal mechanically by moving the antenna further and further forward or reverse, except for the cross coupling between the elements in this case because they're too close, except for that slight error, mechanically moving and electronically moving is doing the exact same thing. To electronically steer a signal in the shack on 2 meters, if you're smart enough, it's fairly easy. To mechanically do it with this rack and pinion assembly and stepper motors is mechanically quite a bit more difficult, but it's doing the same thing. Where people have run into this problem before is when you're building a circular polarized Yagi structure where you've got horizontal elements and vertical elements on the exact same boom, for a whole bunch of mechanical reasons, the verticals are going to be mounted either ahead or behind of the horizontals, so that they don't go through the exact same spot in the boom and hit each other. Let me drop. And in order to make pure circular polarization, you want the signal coming out of the horizontal antenna and the signal coming out of the vertical antenna to be phase-wise 90 degrees apart. One's got to lead the other by 90 degrees, quarter wavelength. You can do that purely electronically if all the elements are co-located, but for mechanical reasons, you can't co-locate the elements. Therefore, if you're smart enough, you do a combination of the two. Maybe you've shifted all the elements of the vertical forward by 20 degrees in phase, from 20 degrees by mechanical motion, 20 degrees out of 360 as a fraction of a wavelength, you've mechanically moved them forward. And then, since you were going to make the upper elements 90 degrees earlier before, and 20 degrees has already been taken up mechanically, you only have to have 70 degrees of electronic phase shift. That's the way you feed the upper element. So by knowing you're combining mechanical phase and electronic phase, you can come out with a beautiful circular polarized antenna, even though some of the elements are further forward on the boom than the other. So what he's doing in his particular case is sort of a subset of that. Once you realize what's going on, mechanical motion and electronic motion, RF-wise, are almost the same. KC2, WGB, K2RIW in the tech band.
2NNU.
KC2, WGB. Now it's recognized. Okay, Dick, I think maybe, I mean, this is a mechanical marvel. There's a lot of mechanics on this, as you can imagine. He might be better off building some type of trombone, if he wants to, at the antenna, and have that operated by the stepper motor, and maybe achieve the same thing. He could make it as a linear piston or something like that. That might work for him. Also, he could do it in the shack. But, yeah, I think he's going about it a little bit wrong. But, boy, he's put a lot of effort, looks like dollars in it. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, for that particular writer, John, this is a very educational experience. And what we're discovering here, that there's, as they used to say, a lot of ways to skin the cat. There's a lot of ways of solving the problem, mechanically, electronically, and combinations thereof. But if you get a hold of the right computer program, and you plug in the phase shift that you're creating by the mechanical motion, and then you look at the three-dimensional antenna pattern you get out of that, and you have to know something about the pattern of one single Yagi first to put that into the program. I didn't say this is easy, but there are programs out there that'll do that. And when you see this as a beautiful three-dimensional pattern in free space, I call it the red apple pattern. When you look at some of these patterns that are made by Mathcad, it really looks like a red apple which has got dimples in it, and the high points and the low points represent the valleys and the peaks of the antenna pattern. And they also change the color as a function of the antenna pattern. With one of those three-dimensional patterns, by plugging in these variables, you'll have a lot of fun modeling it first. This is one of the cases where modeling it first will give you a lot of information that's not necessarily intuitive. Until you've worked with a lot of phased arrays, what really happens when you shift the phase of the signal going to the element and how that interacts with the spacing between the elements and the gain of the individual elements, until you've worked with phased arrays for a while, a lot of that is not intuitive. But what you will discover is the array pattern has got a stronger influence than the element pattern in many situations, but not always. Now, I wonder how many phases... Well, I know that Alex, by way of the ultrasound machines that he's worked on for lots and lots of years, he has worked with phased arrays when some of us hadn't even cut our teeth yet. And so... I bet you've got a lot of opinions on phased arrays, Alex. N2NNU, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. And thank you, John. Yeah, I believe our friend is playing around with what is called beamforming. And yes, it is used in medical imaging, in radar, in sonar, all over the place. It's nothing new. What his mistake is that he used a vertical positioning of the sensors, in our case the antenna, rather than horizontal. If he will put his antennas quarter wavelength separation on the horizontal plane, then he is all set. He doesn't have any need for anything else. As you can remember, Dick, about a year ago, I played around with this, trying to make phase compensation on a single antenna. In other words, I was moving my Cushcraft 11-element antenna back and forth to get the best signal coming from a far away, depending on the phase that it comes into the antenna, which is makes a lot of sense. I wonder why nobody made an antenna like that yet. It is just common sense. Anyhow, speaking about beamforming, two elements are not good enough. He needs at least four elements in any plane that he wants to play with. If he wants to play in that is vertical and horizontal, then he has to construct a 2x2. Or if he wants to play only in horizontal plane, then he has to have a four horizontal antenna synchronized back and forth, so they will give him the best results. He has to have a summer somewhere that will sum the antenna outputs before it goes to the receiver, and he's all set. I believe this is the future that we're gonna go to, and electronic steering is quite easy today. It takes only a couple of chips, and you do a 4x4 without any problem. If there are any comments, I'm glad to answer them. Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, Alex has brought some interesting points out that as we gain experience and know how they really work, to electronically beamform with a phased array using multiple antennas with multiple feed lines going to them, and you electronically adjust amplitude and phase of the signal going to them, which forms the beam in space, that's going to become more popular as people gain more knowledge about it. It doesn't have to be super expensive. It can give you a lot of performance. Electronically, you can steer the beam in microseconds, whereas to rotate your antenna mechanically might take you 15 or 25 seconds. So you get a huge improvement in tuning speed when it comes to swishing that beam in three-dimensional space electronically. One other thing that Alex mentioned is he would recommend the two antennas be side-by-side. I highly agree with that because in most cases, all the signals we talk to are on the horizon and they're just coming at you from some particular azimuth degree. So to steer the beam in azimuth makes a lot of sense. To steer the beam in elevation, most of the time it's not useful. Let me drop. Unless you're working moonbound for radio astronomy or looking for the very unusual propagation conditions where sometimes the signal comes to your QTH at a slightly different elevation angle. But most of us cannot resolve that. That elevation angle change of Mother Nature is only a couple of degrees, and we're using antennas that are 30 and 45 degrees wide. You'll never see it, if you know what I mean. But there's one other thing. When you horizontally stack, you have to choose the right distance. Alex thought that a quarter wavelength would be the right distance, and if they were very simple elements like dipoles, yes. But where this guy is using 15-foot-long, 11-element Yagis, which have an effective capture area of a 10 or a 12-foot diameter circle, in that case, the right stacking distance horizontally or vertically would be something in the vicinity of 10 feet. 8 feet is about the closest you want to get. Any closer than that, the two individual capture areas are so heavily overlapped, even though your eye doesn't see it, the radio wave does, and when the capture areas are that heavily overlapped, that's a fancy way of saying the two antennas are electronically coupled to each other, and even though you've got two feed lines going to the two antennas, and you think you've got two separate feed points, there almost is only one feed point there when they're that electronically coupled, and therefore your ability to steer that beam to do electronic beam forming is nowhere near as good as you would like it to be. It's a more complicated situation. There's a lot to be learned here, and I wish more people would write some articles on electronic beam forming, because the military has discovered a long time ago there's a huge amount of performance to be had, It's just a learning curve that we amateurs have to get used to. KC2, WGB, go ahead with the next one, or the rest of that one if you like, John. K2RIW and the Deck Man.
Okay, Dick. No, that's about it from Mel's Corner. That's it for the week. Most of those questions were in that first group where the three people almost asking identical questions, so that took care of a lot. But, yes, and I love that MathCAD. I only have MathCAD 8, but I love working with that matrix system that they have built into that program. It can give you some lovely patterns, and it can reveal a lot. So, yeah, that's good stuff. Absolutely. So you pick it up from here, Dick, and let's go on with the net. KC2WGB.
2W2VL repeater.
Have another comment?
Go ahead with your phased array comment, Alex.
I mentioned quarter wavelength, thinking of very short wavelength, but you can go as far possible as a half wavelength. However, we have not to forget that there is a phenomenon called space aliasing that will screw up a lot of your data if you are getting over the half wavelength spacing between the sensors, especially when you're talking about a frequency agile system. However, this is not insurmountable with electronics today, so I would suggest for that person, radio amateur, to read as much possible about beamforming, especially in medical imaging, and not in the what is commercially said about antennas in the cellular telephony and so forth. They are quite different. A good source of information comes from Duke University. They have a good section in ultrasonics there, and they will be more than happy to ask to respond to any question you send in to them. Electronic beam forming is the future, and in fact, this is my new radio that I'm working right now on. I actually have a group of four people here in Romania that work on it, and perhaps in the coming months, we're going to have an alpha board that will take four antennas on the 80-meter band and make a steerable 80-meter beamformer. This is the dream out here in Romania. Back to you, Dick.
Alex just brought up a very interesting point, and that is if you want your electronic beam steering system of your phased array to be predictable, the physics is the same whether you do it in ultrasonics or you do it with RF. As long as you know the number of wavelengths of spacing between the elements, mathematically it tells you an awful lot about what's going to happen. And if Alex is correct that you, if you follow his advice and you keep all the elements a quarter wavelength apart or something in that vicinity, the patterns you get are fairly simple and rather predictable as far as what amplitude and phase you feed to the elements and what pattern you get in free space. As you separate the elements more than a quarter wave, half wave, three-quarter wave, one wave, two wave, three waves, the good news is that the electronic steering becomes a little bit sharper. That's the good news. The bad news is you pick up other side lobes. In some cases, they're called grating lobes. In some cases, they're called spatial aliasing lobes. They've got lots of different names for it. But what's really happening is that because of the spacing between the elements being more than a quarter wavelength, you really mean that as you test the antenna pattern, let me pick a number, 30 degrees off of mechanical boresight, you'll pick up a situation where the spacing between the elements is such that spatially you have gone around the clock multiple times. Because you've moved mechanically by 30 degrees, electronically you've moved 360 or 720 degrees, the signal has come around back toward zero effective, so to speak, and you get a lobe in that direction. Grating lobe, aliasing lobe, side lobes, phased array side lobes, they got lots and lots of names for it, but you're going to get other lobes. The only way you can get rid of the effective of those other lobes, let me drop
repeater, timeout, cancel. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Your element pattern dictates by the mathematics that there will be side lobes out in those directions.